Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. Art Spree, the UALR Performing Arts Series, closes its 15-16 season with a performance by the Bowling Jazz Trio, Mark Bowling guitar, Keith Brown drums, and John Hamer bass. Based in Knoxville on the faculty of the University of Tennessee, the trio is active on many fronts, including the Knoxville Jazz Orchestra, blues, rock, funk, fusion, mainstream, and big band. In conversation recently with guitarist Mark Bowling, the trio lost its longtime bassist Rusty Holloway in 2014, who left to perform a full-time career. But a new bassist came to the University of Tennessee Music School and has joined the trio, which where Mark begins our conversation.
Keith Brown, the drummer, and I are both from Tennessee. John Hamer, the bassist, just joined us. He's from Washington State.
You seem to be very intrigued and delighted that things are working the way they are. You'd lost your original bass.
Rusty Holloway was with us for 25 years, and we had played together so long. You know, we could complete each other's sentences, both musically and otherwise, too, because we actually did a lot of teaching together where, you know, situations where we were coaching student groups, and situations where we're working with guest artists. We had a lot of music that we played together, but John's stepped in and just done a beautiful job for us. He joined us in August of last year.
You know, the bass is such a fundamental instrument in this kind of trio.
In a guitar trio, you don't have the flexibility you have in a piano trio because, you know, he obviously, the piano player has got it play two parts with a little bit more freedom. But with the guitar trio, you really need the bass to be a contributing member to defining harmony and thing. John, really a composer as well as a performer, and thinks and performs compositionally. Sometimes on his bass solos, I just get out of the way because I don't know what he's going to reharmonize and where he's going with things. It's really exciting, you know, have a new kind of a new direction there.
Then the original music that you play, are you the principal composer of the trio?
Well, I was for years with the trio, but we are now doing some of John's material, too.
So that adds a new flavor.
Yeah.
Now, have you, the trio, always been associated with the university?
Really, it has. I started teaching here as a graduate student in 1981, and at that point, Rusty Holloway, our original bassist, was teaching here, and Keith Brown, the drummer, was not here then, but within about 2 years he started teaching here. So back in the early days, we actually had Rusty, the bass player, had a band that was kind of a rock cover band. You know, we played everything, you know, from Michael Jackson to jazz standards to all kinds of music at certain points. And and then later, it just kind of developed to into a strictly a jazz guitar trio.
So you've been strictly jazz for, what, 5, 10, 15 years?
More like 25.
So that's your natural home, you feel?
Yes, it is now. We all grew up playing the music of the day, probably 70s rock and funk, blues and things.
And when you have a jazz trio, is there a lot of experimental jazz going on now?
A man named Zim Nwana.
Oh, I mean, I read that in your bio that you sent me.
He kind of changed, you know, some of the ways we approach things. His jazz roots were really in late Coltrane, but he also incorporated a lot of the South African folk idioms and the African rhythms, of course, in what he was doing. And he was very, you know, some of his things almost avant-garde, I guess. But then he would also, within a minute or two, he would be playing a beautiful melody. So his music related to people on knew nothing about jazz. They could get into his music. We actually recorded a concert here in I think it was 2005, and then they released a recording in South Africa, and it won their South African Music Award for Best Traditional Jazz Album. They call it their SAMMY Award, like the Grammy. They emailed us to tell us, yeah, we won a SAMMY Award, and I was like, okay, yeah, what do we get? Well, sorry, you don't get anything because you're not South African. But it was nice to be able to be on that recording.
You mentioned rhythm, because that's something one associates with all African music.
All of the jazz music is really rooted in African rhythm. It kind of meshed with European harmonies and different approach to melodies. One of the things I've found in my playing, I kind of started as a blues player, but still, even when I write music now, still I'll write something and I'll think, okay, this is a different kind of tune. And then after I, you know, step away and look at it a little more, I realize I'm still writing blues tunes, rooted in blues, and you know, of course the swing element is something we're still very involved in. A lot of contemporary jazz musicians seem to be trying to get away from swinging, but we still feel like it's an important part of the idiom. So,
well, wouldn't you say that the states that abut Memphis are all affected by the blues? Whether you go as far east as Tennessee and further, and certainly in Arkansas, and anything that the Mississippi flows through, blues comes into it.
Oh, it's an essential element of all American music, really. You know, all the pop music and, of course, jazz. It's rooted in blues. And it's interesting that over 100 years later, it's still that influential.
Yes, it's something about the rhythms and the harmonies and the touch of melancholy that threads its way through everything that you don't probably realize until afterwards how much effect that has when you're composing yourself and when you're listening to fresh compositions, that there is that inevitable link in history. When you compose, are the ideas spontaneous, that you suddenly get something and you think, I've got to write this down and play it and see what it sounds like?
Yeah, a lot of that happens in practice sessions, you know, when you're just working on other things and you'll suddenly stumble on something. Usually, you know, for me, sometimes it's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you make a mistake when you're practicing and you go, hey, that sounds pretty good. You know, I could make something out of that. But occasionally it's you know, we do a lot of, jazz musicians do a lot of transcription of other people's music to learn songs, but also to learn, you know, to transcribe people's improvisations. It's a big part of the way we teach improvisations. We have our students transcribe improvised solos. So as you're going through those things and learning other people's improvisations, a lot of times you discover things about the music that you like, and often you can build on somebody else's idea and change it enough so it's not recognizable.
Mm-hmm. What would you say have been highlights of your career to date? You go way back, and you know, sort of starting afresh with a new member of the trio, and leading you perhaps to come up with slightly different compositions of your own. There's a spark of individuality that a new person inevitably is going to bring when he comes in to join you.
Yes, I'm excited about where we're headed now. I think we're actually opening up some new directions, because we had kind of established a style that we basically stuck with for a lot of years. But, you know, as far as highlights, you know, playing with my trio, we played a jazz festival in Japan. It was really fun for us to get to travel to Japan. The people there are so so receptive to jazz music, and we had a great time on the trip. Also, we played with the Knoxville Jazz Orchestra. Some of the guest artists' names in jazz are featured guest artists with that band, so we've really had a great experience just getting to kind of rub elbows and play concerts. Last Christmas concert, we had Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, the young singer who just won the Grammy for Best Jazz Vocalist, and she was playing alongside her was something, because she has a voice that's you could compare her to Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan, and she would just do something. She could just make some sounds that you would send shivers down your back.
What sort of size is a jazz orchestra?
The Knoxville Jazz Orchestra is a 16-piece big band. It started by another colleague of ours at the University of Tennessee, a trumpeter named Vance Thompson. He's done quite well with it. And in terms of, I think we've recorded, six or seven CDs and played it. Festivals, and they've actually toured Europe. This has been several years ago. I'm not involved with that orchestra on every concert. I basically told them, if somebody comes in with guitar parts, call me, but if they don't have guitar parts, don't call me.
Reasonable.
I play with them.
So the guitar in a jazz orchestra is not a traditional voice?
In certain styles it is. In Count Basie style, you always had Freddie Green in the rhythm section chunking out chord changes, but a lot of the jazz band writing and arranging now is more along the Thad Jones, Mel Lewis model or Maria Schneider model, which is it's not so much dance music, it's more art music.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to use Jim Hall's quote. Jim Hall was one of my favorite jazz guitarists, and he said, when they prune the tree of jazz, all that will be left is Freddie Green. So Freddie Green would sit in the Count Basie rhythm section, and one of the things he always did was they played a lot of dances. He would pick out the best dancers on the floor and watch them and really make the whole band groove based on them. On the dancers, and would play these simple 2 and 3 note chords on a rhythm on a acoustic guitar that actually drove that whole band.
Fascinating. Tell me something, because you've got to go in a minute or two. What are you going to bring with you when you come to here for Art Spree? Will you come with a set program, or will it be spontaneous? What you want to feel like at the time when you're there?
Well, it'll be somewhat set. We know there are certain of our original music that we want to play, but we actually have a pretty wide repertoire, and so there's always the time when you get into a room and you have something called and you go, no, let's do something else. You know, Duke Ellington said jazz is the sound of surprise.
That's
so
nice.
So sometimes, you know, you have to kind of trick yourself to surprise yourself with what's going to happen. But you do want to keep that feeling and atmosphere of spontaneity. Because if I'm playing like I know exactly everything that's going to happen, you know, it may not have the same level of energy as if we don't all know what's going to happen.
That was Mark Bowling, guitarist in the Bowling Jazz Trio, coming to Little Rock to close the 15-16 University Art Spree Series, Sunday, April 3rd at 3 p.m. in the Stella Boyle-Smith Concert Hall at UANR. For more information, call the box office, 501-569-8995, or the music department, 501-569-3294. Harding University in Searcy brings an interesting variety of musical programs to its annual concert series. This year, last month, the Chamber Orchestra Kremlin, And March 31st, the piano duo, pianist Tatiana Reutemann and violinist Cindy Wu. Cindy Wu is well known as soloist, chamber musician, and educator throughout North America, Europe, and Asia. Among her many awards is the Milka Violin Artist Prize from the Curtis Institute of Music. She is currently artist in residence of the Dulcamera Society in Los Angeles. Pianist Tatiana Reutemann is the wife of Philip Mann, the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra's music director, and has graduate degrees from the Manhattan School of Music, the Royal Academy of Music in London, and a DMA in piano performance from the University of Minnesota. Her recording of the original big band version of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue is on the Naxos album Jazz Nocturne, American Concerts of the Jazz Age. Tatiana and Cindy Wu are close friends and perform together when possible. They were heard in Little Rock's Trinity Cathedral closing the first WAMA Festival, the Wildwood Academy for Music and the Arts, 2 years ago. So it's great to have them here to talk about this engagement. With Cindy Wu in California, the distance is well served by Skype, as the conversation covers the planning of the program and how they met.
First was the hanging out.
Yes.
But wondering.
Yes.
Because we met in San Diego back then when we were both doing some concerts. Yeah. Separate concerts, but we were staying at the same host family and the host, they were not home. And so every day when we were not rehearsing, we would hang out at the beautiful house and then we bonded throughout that mm-hmm. time. I think it was about a week. After we bonded, we didn't really make music together, but after Tatiana started taking on the role of running WAMA back then, she thought I would be a good person to come in because I was teaching at USC, and then I also was very, very often working in chamber music settings, playing with a lot of, I wouldn't call them children, they're all young adults. So I think she thought I would be a good fit. And then also she wanted to make music together. And then so she invited me over and then we had a recital on top of the teaching that we were doing, right?
Did you find that you had a similar taste in music in terms of the things you had done and that you wanted to do?
We were both very, very open-minded to different styles of, and different periods and different nationality of music. Yeah. And I think we were very excited to be able to explore some things together. I think it was that open mind that we both had. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's also very important in musicians is to because we are here to understand and to get to know and experience. And I think only with an open mind, you can really bond in the experience.
You have such a wide range of visits to different countries. Are you originally from the Far East?
I am from Taiwan originally, and every time people ask me this question, I explain that I came to this country when I was 14. And of course, I have spent a lot of time doing festivals and activities in Europe and also some other Asian countries, and have done outreach in other parts of Asian countries. Like I've done a few weeks in Laos and just outreaching to rural communities and then people that have never heard classical music before. So anyway, I came to this country when I was 14 and I have been here ever since. So if you really count the years of me being here compared to the years I was in Taiwan, I actually have been here much longer. More and more, I feel like I am half and half and very, very Americanized because if you consider the teenage years a big part of you growing into the person you are, I think that was a big part of my teenage years being spent here. I actually speak Mandarin and because in the city, I grew up in Taipei, that's the capital, and right. Then most of us only speak Mandarin. And even though my parents and grandparents, they spoke Taiwanese, but I would respond in Mandarin to them. So I actually don't speak Taiwanese. And I didn't learn English till I was coming here. I was terrible at English when I was in Taiwan. We had English class and I was so bad. And I really was genuinely curious to understand everything. And my questioning upset this teacher so much that she actually, I think she was an intern teacher. And then she ended up like crying or something after a class with me.
So Mandarin would have been much more useful then for the whole of the Orient almost, wouldn't it?
Right, yeah.
Very sensible.
It's very interesting, as Cindy mentioned, that she came over when she was 14, and I realized I came over when I was 13. So in a similar manner, I spent the larger bulk of my life in North America between Canada and the United States. So I think that's another thing that I just found out that we had in common, that we're this amalgam where our teenage years were spent in North America while we were born in a different country. Mm-hmm. So you become a sort of a morphed being between two cultures.
Well, did you speak Russian mostly mm-hmm. when you first came to Canada and places?
Yes, I studied English in school, but it was just second language, I guess, starting in grade 5, and it was very primitive. Mm-hmm. It allowed me to read, of course, and to write and to count, and I knew the alphabet and some very basic elements that were a good start, but I would not call that speaking.
No, but did you maintain it? Do you talk Russian with your boys?
Yes.
With your boy?
Yes, I speak Russian fluently. I read Russian on a regular basis to maintain the language. I write in Russian regularly. So I make a big effort to keep my language. And some people are actually quite surprised that I'm as fluent as I am, considering how young I was. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy languages, and that's my mother tongue. And so that's very important.
There's so much new music coming out of the West, so many new, very vibrant young composers with all kinds of ideas of trying this and trying that. Is that happening out East as well, that they're all in an age group that wants to break away from some of the traditions and try some ideas that they've been thinking of themselves or just talking amongst themselves?
Absolutely. I actually think it's a, well, art is the fruit of life, of humanity, and of cultures, and then I think the earliest music was people crying over their relatives dying, and I think the crying ends up becoming like songs. I think that might have been something that was a very early form of music that they consider, or singing. And so in a way, which reminds me, recently I've done a concert of this this woman. It definitely was inspired by the Pierre Lunaire style of a composer that very, very recently just died, Peter Maxwell Davies. Mm-hmm. And then we did this this composition with a woman the soprano was behind me, and then she was sort of talking and singing all at the same time in different pitches, and then at some point she was like screaming right into my ears. And so it's very interesting, and it definitely reminds me of the story of the people crying over their relatives, the words, and then the crying turns into songs. And then so that's why I totally can imagine every culture of people growing up in different surrounding and different, like, you know, there are a lot of composers that are inspired by birds, by just listening to birds singing. They write music to it, and they're also like Dvorak was inspired by the trains, you know, the choo choo, you know, like I think he wrote that into his music. And so I think music, the inspiration of music is everywhere. And then while I'm sure that there are a lot of people that can be completely originally creative with whatever voice that they find in their head, but I think culture definitely plays on a big part of it. Like there are a lot of Chinese, Taiwanese composers that write music that has a pentatonic scale influence, you know, which brings me to pentatonic scale actually influences also Native American music and African American music and Hungarian music also. Mm-hmm. So in a way, they, even with different cultures, that's based on some sort of a same, you know, if we call it like a music theory term, the pentatonic scale, it's still like is creating tons of very different flavors of music. And I think that's what makes the music so interesting, is the different flavors that getting to these people's lives that are inspiring them to hear different music and then write them down.
I wondered what you take in mind when you're putting together a program, the two of you, with the background that you've just been discussing, whether you want to bring in something new or maybe even something further back that they might not have had any experience of hearing.
Well, that's what we're thinking. You know, I think a variety is usually a safe and a very proper and appropriate, I think, choice to go with. Leclerc, which is a Baroque piece, Baroque sonata by a French composer. And then, of course, we will play the Debussy piano and violin sonata, which is also French. Of course, you know, Brahms sonata, it's a big staple of chamber music repertoire. One of the three will be doing number two. I thought, you know, Gershwin would be very appropriate. You know, it's jazzy. I think it would be more familiar in this area. And a bit, in a way, it ties the whole program together because, you know, of course, the French composers, Impressionists, were influenced by jazz. Gershwin is fairly transparent, fairly languid in that aspect, but, you know, it's more familiar.
So you've got your program. Mm-hmm. When you go anywhere, really, doesn't matter whether it's here in Arkansas, which is really getting quite sophisticated audiences in terms Absolutely. Of what they hear, and with the number of colleges that we have with interesting people on board, I was just thinking how this country, as with any large country, has such variety, and you've got one particular composer who is American, that you would have difficulty sometimes to decide because you're just finding new pieces yourselves and thinking, ah, it'd be rather fun to try this one. We haven't done it yet.
There has been so much great music written. It's like hard to pick our things that we really look forward to exploring and sharing with people. And I think that the thing with a lot of the music we've picked, and I think, you know, there is a little fun in the Gershwin. I mean, there's a lot of fun. Okay, not just a little. It's a lot of fun in the Gershwin. And then there's also a lot of sultry. And then there's also, it's really beautiful melodic music and some really rhythmic music. And then in the Debussy, there's also that dreamy and then the impressionistic flavors. And then the Leclerc. And I think he was a lace maker. So he was both a musician and a lace maker. So his music has a lot of that little intricate patterns and then responses and then also the symmetry. And then there are so many qualities. And of course, Brahms is the master of human expressions. And I think these things are the audience would probably always enjoy exploring how they can relate to the music. And I think that's what we are not afraid of programming whatever mm-hmm. we like and Absolutely. We relate to, because we pretty much challenge people to discover how they can relate to the music that we present.
That I feel very important in terms of the programming, but also the performance aspect and delivering the piece itself to the audience is the energy that we as performers bring. And that's one of the reasons I love playing with Cindy, because to me it really doesn't matter if we're playing Debussy, Stravinsky or Brahms or Dvorak. I think we have an amazing chemistry on stage, and the listeners feel that. What makes a performance exciting, it's not just the piece itself, because I think many great pieces can be played quite badly and without any energy, without doing them justice. But I think if the performers know what they're doing and if the performers love what they're doing, you can play even the most simple piece and the audience will go crazy and jump up and down. So that's, I think, one of the things that we really strive, not just play for our own enjoyment, but also to bring the energy of the piece out, to really bring out what makes each individual piece unique and exciting. And I think that's hopefully what our audiences will hear.
Tatiana Reutmann piano and Cindy Wu violin. The duo, which will play in Searcy on the Harding University Concert Series, Thursday, March the 31st, in Reynolds Recital Hall at 7 p.m. For more information, call 501-299-4343. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.